This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 15th of August, these are the main stories. Canada's Parliamentary Ethics Commissioner has found that the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, tried to influence his former Attorney General to settle a criminal case. US stock markets have fallen sharply on growing fears of a recession. Days after suffering a heavy defeat in the polls, the Argentine President Mauricio Macri has announced a number of populist economic measures. Also in this podcast,
the fossilised bones were discovered last year in an old riverbed. They're from a previously unknown species of penguin that's thought to have stood 1.6 metres tall.
The remains of a penguin the size of a human have been found in New Zealand. First to Canada, and the country's Parliamentary Ethics Commissioner has found that the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, violated rules by trying to influence his former Attorney General to settle a criminal case against an engineering giant, SNC-Lavalin. Mr. Trudeau has denied exerting undue influence over Jody Wilson-Raboul in this particular case. He added that he took full responsibility for what happened, but said he could not apologise for standing up for Canadian jobs.
I want to thank the Ethics Commissioner for his report. And even though I disagree with some of his conclusions, I fully accept this report. We need to be able to talk about the impacts on Canadians right across the country of decisions being made. But what happened over the past year shouldn't have happened. I take responsibility for it. We need to make sure that my government or any government going forward never is in that situation again.
My colleague Julian Marshall spoke to Robert Fife, the bureau chief in Ottawa for the Globe and Mail newspaper, and asked him for more on the background to the story.
SNC-Lavalin is a large international construction and engineering firm with very, very close connections to the Liberal government in Ottawa and to the Quebec wing of the Liberal Party. In fact, they had been convicted of $100,000 of illegal contributions to the federal Liberal Party. They had been facing charges, very serious charges involving bribery in Libya, and they wanted to have a deferred prosecution agreement. Canada did not have any of this legislation. Britain does have it. So they went to work on the Prime Minister's office. They got that legislation through over the objections of the Attorney General. And after the legislation was passed, the Prime Minister and his top aides began to pressure the Attorney General to override the Director of Public Prosecutions and allow for a deferred prosecution agreement for SNC-Lavalin. She refused, and this pressure continued. And then in January of this year, 2019, she was demoted to Veterans Affairs. And then we broke the story several months later, and we now have the Ethics Commissioner saying very clearly that the Prime Minister in his office, quote, was used to circumvent, undermine, and ultimately attempt to discredit the decision of the Director of Public Prosecutions, as well as the authority of Ms. Wilson-Raybo as the Crown's Chief Law Officer. Ms. Wilson-Raybo was the Justice Minister who was demoted when she refused the Prime Minister's and his top aides' request to give a favorable deal to SNC-Lavalin. That's the story.
Mr. Trudeau's defense throughout has been what?
Mr. Trudeau has said that, first of all, when I first broke that story, he said the allegations were false. That's now clearly he can't say that anymore. So even today, after the release of this report, he's gone on to say that, he had the best of intentions. They may not have handled this very well, but the best intention was to save Canadian jobs.
Very, very briefly, Mr. Fife, will Mr. Trudeau be politically damaged by this? Briefly.
Yes, he will be. We have an election that will begin sometime in September for October 21st. The opposition parties have already come out today saying that Mr. Trudeau should be punished for it in the election. It could very well mean a minority government for the Liberals.
Robert Fife. Key indicators for the health of the US and British economies are pointing to similar circumstances to that of 2007, before the banking crisis and the global economic crash. The US Treasury bond yield curve has inverted, which it has done in all but one of the recessions for the past half century. Britain's equivalent has also reversed. Shares in New York and London dipped sharply on the news. I asked our economics correspondent Andrew Walker to explain the significance of the so-called inversion on the interest rates of government bonds.
The point here is that under normal circumstances, investors who lend money to governments by buying their bonds in the financial markets want to be compensated for tying their money up for longer periods, which means that they would normally expect to get a higher return on a 10-year bond than they would on a 2-year.
So-called yield or interest.
Indeed,
rate.
Yeah. It's a measure of the government's cost of borrowing. Under normal circumstances, the longer the period that you're lending for, the higher the return you want to get as compensation for tying your money up. That has gone into reverse for this 2-year and 10-year comparison for the United States and the UK. And as you indicated, that's a very unusual situation. And it often is the precursor to a recession. I think it's worth making one
health warning.
One health warning, yeah, which is that things might be rather unusual at the moment because the 10-year, the longer-term one, is being pulled down to some extent because of quantitative easing. Central banks have bought so much of this stuff that it has pulled the yield down to relatively unusual levels. So that might just be distorting the picture somewhat.
When was the last time, can you say, that an inverted yield curve did not presage a recession? Are we talking decades now, aren't we?
Well, certainly in the case of the United States, where the research has been done most extensively, the answer is yes, it is indeed. In the last 60 years, there's always been either a recession or, in a few cases, a marked slowdown in growth.
One final question. Germany. It's shrinking.
Yes, indeed. So and Germany does seem to have been affected by international trade tensions. The German spending by consumers and investment by business did rise, but there was a decline in exports, and that dragged the German growth figure below zero.
Andrew Walker. Argentina's President Mauricio Macri has made a televised address to announce a series of measures to alleviate the impact of the economic crisis 3 days after he suffered a heavy defeat at the polls. Our America's editor Leonardo Rocha reports.
President Macri has frozen petrol prices for 90 days, lowered income tax and increased social benefits. Under Argentina's unique voting system, all candidates took part in a first vote on Sunday. The left-wing opposition candidate Alberto Fernandez won by a landslide and is now the front-runner. Mr. Macri's measures, after 4 years of austerity, may have come too late to ensure that he gets another term.
Leonardo Rocha there. A New York woman who said she was sexually assaulted by Jeffrey Epstein is suing the disgraced financier's estate and his associates. Jennifer Arose alleges that she was raped by Jeffrey Epstein after a long grooming process by 4 of his associates, including a recruiter, a secretary and a maid. It's the first in a wave of expected lawsuits under a landmark New York state law called the Child Victims Act. The legislation came into effect on Wednesday and opens a 1-year window for victims to sue over alleged sexual abuse, regardless of how long ago it occurred. From New York, Nada Tawfiq reports.
Jennifer Arose's lawsuit says she was approached outside her performing arts school when she was 14 years old by a brunette in her 20s. The woman allegedly befriended her and told her that Epstein could introduce her to the right people in the acting world and help her struggling family. Arose claims that together they visited Epstein on several occasions at his mansion, and each time he would give her $300. Jennifer Arose says after a month, Ghislaine Maxwell, daughter of the British publishing magnate Robert Maxwell, arranged for her to meet Epstein alone. Once there, she claims Epstein took her to a room with a massage table and asked her to rub his back. She alleges that led to numerous sexual encounters that became more aggressive over the course of a year and ended with Epstein brutally raping her. She says she's angry that Jeffrey Epstein won't have to personally answer to her in court, but that her quest for justice is just starting. The BBC has tried to speak to Ghislaine Maxwell for a response to the lawsuit, but in the past, she has denied any role in Epstein's involvement with underage girls.
Nada Tawfiq there. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has accused MPs who oppose Brexit of a terrible collaboration with the European Union, putting him at odds with the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond. Mr. Johnson warned that the EU would become more adamant in refusing to reopen negotiations the more it thought that Parliament could block Brexit. The EU has consistently said that it is willing to talk about the future relationship and clarify, but not change, the withdrawal agreement which Theresa May had agreed last November. Mr. Hammond said Mr. Johnson's advisers had, in effect, wrecked the prospects of a deal by rejecting the provisions for avoiding a hard border in Ireland. Our political correspondent Jonathan Blake reports.
Since becoming Prime Minister, Boris Johnson has consistently blamed the EU for the lack of progress towards a new Brexit deal. His comments during a live video on Facebook, in which questions from the public were selected in advance by Downing Street, continued in that vein. Mr. Johnson said there was a terrible kind of collaboration going on between people at Westminster who think they can block Brexit in Parliament and our European friends. The EU, he said, was not willing to compromise because it still thought Brexit could be blocked in Parliament, adding that the longer that went on, the more likely it would be that the UK left without a deal. That position was fiercely criticised by the former Chancellor Philip Hammond in his first significant political intervention since leaving office. In an apparent swipe at Boris Johnson's senior adviser Dominic Cummings, the former director of the Vote Leave campaign, Mr. Hammond said the unelected people who pull the strings of this government knew that demanding the removal of the Northern Ireland backstop, designed to prevent a hard border with the Republic of Ireland if a trade deal can't be reached, was something the EU could not and would not agree to.
Well, leaving the EU without a deal would be just as much a betrayal of the referendum result as not leaving at all. Pivoting to say that the backstop has to go in its entirety, a huge chunk of the withdrawal agreement just scrapped, is effectively a wrecking tactic.
It was a travesty of the truth, Mr. Hammond claimed, to pretend that in 2016 Leave voters voted for a hard no-deal Brexit, and there was no popular or parliamentary mandate to do that. His comments were met with derision from Downing Street. A source said the UK would leave on the 31st of October despite Mr. Hammond's best efforts to the contrary. The business minister, Kwasi Kwarteng, said the former Chancellor had changed his tune.
He was Chancellor of the Exchequer for 3 years. We had a clear position. We were going to either have a deal or no deal. His job was to prepare the Treasury and the country to face the eventuality of no deal. I remember in the 2017 budget, he set billions aside to prepare for no deal. He expressly said that. You can look at his speeches.
Philip Hammond said it was time for the government to demonstrate its commitment to a genuine negotiation. The Prime Minister maintains he does want a new Brexit deal. But as long as he appears willing to allow the UK to leave the EU without one, Mr. Hammond and others on the Tory backbenches will do what they can to stop that.
Jonathan Blake. Earlier, the Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, reiterated that there would be no chance of a trade agreement with Britain passing the US Congress if Brexit undermined peace in Northern Ireland. From Washington, John Sopel.
When you think of the main players in the Brexit drama, Nancy Pelosi is probably not one of those who you'd imagine could have a central role. But any new trade deal negotiated between the UK and the US has to get through Congress. And today, in an important intervention, she makes clear that if a no-deal Brexit is implemented, with no Irish backstop to prevent the reintroduction of a hard border, then there is no chance that it will get through the House of Representatives. Whatever form it takes, Brexit cannot be allowed to imperil the Good Friday Agreement, including the seamless border between the Irish Republic and Northern Ireland, she says. And adds, we cannot go back.
John Sopel. Staying with Northern Ireland, 50 years ago this week, on the 14th of August 1969, the British Army was sent onto the streets of Belfast and Londonderry to calm civil disorder. What was thought to be a temporary measure turned into the longest continuous campaign in British military history, lasting more than 30 years. 3,600 lives were lost in Operation Banner, or The Troubles, as it became known. A commemorative ceremony was held on Wednesday at the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire in central England. The British Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, was there.
I think it's important we remind people of our success, remind people of the sacrifice. Over 1,400 people died from our armed forces in Op Banner. That's a huge number. We were losing 100 people a year in the early 70s to a place that's only a few miles across the sea. And I think that's why we should value Op Banner, we should value the veterans that fought in it and were part of it and brought, you know, defence to those people that couldn't defend themselves.
Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page has been considering the legacy of so many years of conflict. He begins with how the BBC reported the sectarian violence which led to the soldiers being sent to Northern Ireland.
A stunned Belfast woke up to scars reminiscent of the Blitz, only more sinister and more horrible.
The army arrived in Northern Ireland in the midst of lethal fighting. Thousands of people were burned out of their homes, mostly Catholics. Initially, members of the nationalist community welcomed the soldiers as a peacekeeping force.
What sort of reception do you think the troops would get in this district?
Oh, excellent. The people are asking me, for God's sake, all over the place, are the troops coming in? They have confidence in the troops.
But that mood changed drastically as the troubles escalated. Policing was extremely controversial in nationalist areas, and the army's role in supporting the Royal Ulster Constabulary generated strong hostility. But unionists generally believed the army was a vital brake on a slide into anarchy. In recent years, there's been more scrutiny of soldiers' actions. The government apologised for the killings of 13 civil rights protesters on Bloody Sunday in 1972. Several former soldiers are currently being prosecuted over killings from the Troubles. The former head of the army, Lord Dannett, has said there should be protections for veterans.
My last morning as Chief of the General Staff in 2009, the last appointment I had in my office was two investigators from the Police Service of Northern Ireland coming to quiz me about something that my platoon was involved in back in 1973. It is bad for the morale of serving soldiers. It's terrible for veteran soldiers.
But victims of state killings see the Army's legacy very differently. Mark Thompson is from the campaign group Relatives for Justice.
367 people killed by the British Army and the RUC. Over 300 of those killed by the British Army, the vast majority uninvolved, unarmed civilians. The British state don't want the account for what its armed forces did here.
How deaths from the conflict should be investigated remains perhaps the most complex and contentious issue in Northern Ireland. The government's considering how to legislate for new agencies to take on the task.
Chris Page in Northern Ireland. Later in the podcast...
Of course, this is rather disturbing because we're taking samples in a very remote area in the Arctic.
Pure Arctic snow is not so pure. Scientists find traces of microplastics, rubber and ship's varnish. Air accident investigators in Britain say the Argentine footballer Emiliano Sala was exposed to a high level of carbon monoxide while flying from France to Wales in January when his plane crashed into the Channel. The body of the pilot, David Ibbotson, has not been found, but the reports suggest he would have also been affected as the cockpit and the cabin were not separated in the Piper Malibu aircraft. Tests showed Mr. Sala's blood had a CO saturation level of 58%. Ben James spoke to the BBC's Rory Carson in Wales and began by asking him to remind us what we know about what happened earlier this year.
Well, Emiliano Sala was the striker, the Argentine striker, who had just signed for Cardiff City for $15 million. They were at the time in the Premier League. That was from French side Nantes, where he was a real fan's favourite. And he was on his way to join his new teammates on the 21st of January, having spent the day saying goodbye to everyone in France. He boarded a private plane alongside pilot David Ibbotson, and just north of Guernsey, the plane went down and crashed into the sea. Now, David Ibbotson's body was never recovered, but thanks to a privately funded search, which included donations from the likes of French footballer Kylian Mbappe, Emiliano Sala's body was found in February. Since then, the Air Accident Investigation Branch, the AAIB, have been trying to ascertain how both passengers died and the circumstances surrounding the plane crashing. And obviously, today's revelation about carbon monoxide levels could shed some light on what might have happened.
Yeah, and as I understand it, they don't go on to speculate what that might mean, but it could give us some more information about the circumstances that led to that plane going down in the first place.
Absolutely, absolutely. The first thing to say is that carbon monoxide, it's an odourless and a colourless gas. Symptoms at low exposure levels can be things like drowsiness or dizziness. But as the exposure level increases, it can lead to unconsciousness and ultimately death. And the suggestion of this report is that levels in Emiliano Sala's blood were so high that they could have caused a seizure, unconsciousness or a heart attack. Now, the engine of the Piper Malibu, which was the plane involved in the crash, can produce high levels of carbon monoxide. The gas It's normally conveyed away from the aircraft through the exhaust system, but if there is poor sealing or there are leaks into the heating and ventilation system, it can get into the cabin. Now, it seems likely that the pilot would have also been exposed to this carbon monoxide prior to crashing. The AAIB have said that the investigation continues to look into a wide range of areas in relation to this accident, but in particular they're looking at the ways in which carbon monoxide could have entered the cabin in this type of aircraft.
Rory Carson in Wales. Microplastics are very small pieces of plastic that pollute the environment and are the most widespread form of debris in the world's oceans. And now they've been found in Arctic snow, according to new research. Scientists in Germany say tests reveal that a litre of snow from the remote Svalbard archipelago contains more than 10,000 particles of plastic, rubber and ship varnish, as well as natural fibres. From the Norwegian Arctic, Roger Harriman reports.
I'm walking through deep snow in an absolutely gorgeous Arctic scene. The snow is firmly fixed to the sides of the trees, the branches dripping with a heavy load of the stuff that's white and pure. But actually, look a little closer and it's not pure at all. Right in front of me is Dr. Melanie Bergmann from the Alfred Wegener Institute in Germany. And she has a small metal flask and she's filling it with snow with a serving spoon. Melanie, you're researching into snow. What are you finding?
Well, we found a lot of plastic particles in the snow. And of course, this is rather disturbing because we're taking samples in a very remote area in the Arctic.
The amount of plastic fragments found here has taken Dr. Bergmann aback. There are microparticles of rubber and fibres in the snow samples too.
I mean, we did expect some, but not nearly as many. Yeah, it was more than 10,000 particles per litre melted snow. So, yeah, that's a lot.
Some people are going to find that rather shocking.
Yeah, well, it is shocking, and it's also important because it does bear relevance in terms of what does it do to us, because there is the risk that we may be breathing in airborne microplastic, because if you find it in snow, it means that it has been in the air before.
In nearby Tromsø, they're clearing the road after a heavy fall of the white stuff we used to consider pristine. I asked Elbjørg Sophie Heimstad, research director at the nearby Norwegian Institute for Air Research, where the pollution came from.
It comes from Europe, from Asia, from Africa, but it is hard to say. They are not a specific place that it comes from. It's quite global spread. Some of these pollutants.
It's easy to understand how microplastics are in water because plastic gets into water and breaks down, but how does microplastic get into snow?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It can be from more local sources in the city areas where it comes from maybe rubber, from tires, from car tires too. We are not sure about that because these are really small particles that may be transported by air masses, by wind.
So it's still a bit of a scientific puzzle.
Yeah, it is.
Tourists still trek here for the appearance of wilderness. Dog sledding is booming. But how do people feel about plastic snow?
That's really bad. It contains plastic and we inhale plastic.
Well, I think it's terrible. I don't think it's supposed to be like that. I think it's something that we really should be more aware of as sort of mankind, that we're having that impact on the planet.
It makes me incredibly sad, to be honest. Like, up here we see the beauty of all of this every single day and we live with it. And to see that it's changing so much and much of it is just vanishing and being tainted, it hurts. It's sad, very sad.
Sad, perhaps, but here's the truth. There is nowhere on the planet to escape pollution from us, however hard you run.
Roger Harriman there in the Norwegian Arctic. In Kenya, one of the top Twitter trends has been MCSK. That's the Music Copyright Society of Kenya. They collect and pay Kenyan musicians the royalties that their music earns. Some musicians in the country have been criticising the MCSK for the royalties they've been paid, some as low as just $24. One of the biggest musicians in Kenya, the award-winning rapper Calligraph Jones, posted about his royalties on Instagram, which started a conversation among Kenyans online. Ben James asked him what his reaction was when he received a message regarding his payments.
Man, I was like, oh, what the hell is happening out here? These guys are paying me peanuts. And despite the fact that I'm one of the biggest artists in Kenya and they're sending me $25, I'm like, yo, man, these guys are crazy, you know? So I decided to just basically start a debate, and I put it up on my Instagram. I put that screenshot of the amount of money they had sent me on my Instagram, and that sparked a conversation. But it was crazy, man. I was actually laughing. It's a funny scenario.
$2,500 shillings, it's around $24. What was that for, as far as you understood? For what length of time? What
apparently,
was it for in particular?
This is the money that they've been collecting on my behalf in a span of 3 years. So 2,500 is what I've earned as an artist for the 3 years that I've been performing, you know? So $25 for 3 years. And this is an A-list artist in Kenya. So you can only imagine, man.
What do you normally get? You must have had these notifications before, have you?
No, man. There has been a lot of, you know, just a bunch of cases, you know, concerning the way the system is. Apparently, there's a lot of corruption, you know? I think 2 years ago, they told us that they were going to fix it and there was going to be proper compensation for the artist and the performers and all that. So this was 2 years ago.
The Kenyan rapper Calligraph Jones talking to Ben James. Later, the MCSK released an updated statement to say the payment of around $24 was for just 2 months. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The famous inscription on the Statue of Liberty in New York as a physical embodiment of the mass immigration to the US in the 19th and 20th centuries. But now a leading member of the Trump administration has suggested that the famous quote should be amended to reflect the latest wave of immigration from non-European countries. Jonathan Savage reports.
It comes, Joe, from the head of Citizenship and Immigration Services, Ken Cuccinelli. He announced new limits on legal migrants getting certain benefits like public housing and food aid. And he was asked if the spirit of that famous verse, which comes from a poem called The New Colossus, still applied. Yes, he said, but it applied to those, I quote, who can stand on their own 2 feet and who will not become a public charge. That was controversial enough for some, but he went further in another interview stating that the poem only referred to people coming from Europe. Much of the modern debate around immigration, of course, concerns those from Latin America.
So how did people react to such a controversial statement?
Well, with fury in some cases. Beto O'Rourke, who's a Democratic presidential candidate, he tweeted, "This administration finally admitted what we've known all along. They think the Statue of Liberty only applies to white people." That's pretty typical of that side of the argument. To get the other side, Ken Cuccinelli was asked by reporters on Monday if Latino people should feel targeted by the stance taken by the White House.
If we had been having this conversation 100 years ago, it would have applied to more Italians. It would have, you know, we can go, well, that's just fine. The divisiveness may be more rhetorical, and I hope that you all in your role will help cure that.
In any event, immigration and how migrants are treated once they enter the US is likely to play a big part in the debate as the US prepares to choose its president again in 2020.
Jonathan Savage. The remains of a giant penguin the size of a human have been discovered in New Zealand. It's just one of a number of large birds that once roamed the country. Michael Bristow reports.
The fossilised bones were discovered last year in an old riverbed. They're from a previously unknown species of penguin that's thought to have stood 1.6 metres tall. It weighed up to 80 kilograms. By comparison, the largest penguin alive today, the emperor, grows to just 1 metre 20. The new discovery has been dubbed the monster penguin and lived around 60 million years ago, when New Zealand was far warmer than today. It's not the country's only extinct giant penguin. Another species was confirmed 5 years ago after its remains, dug up in 1971, had languished in an Auckland shed for several decades. New Zealand has in the past been home to a number of other huge birds too, including the moa, which could reach an enormous 3.6 metres tall before they were all hunted to extinction. And just last week it was announced that scientists had unearthed a new species of giant parrot.
Michael Bristow. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.
Music Life.
It's just to talk about our journeys and how we've got here and what music is to us.
Music Life.
A crowd singing back to you. Yeah. That to me is the most satisfying thing.
Music Life.
My favourite thing about music is we can all listen to it and have a completely different experience.
Music Life.
You have to say, okay, right, I do mean this.
Music Life.
What's going on in this room right now?
A brand new podcast from the BBC World Service.
I want to talk about how this is ruining your life.
Bringing together musicians from across the globe.
I love this. This is brilliant.
Talking to each other about how they make their music.
When you're just having a good time, you're the most free. There's less pressure to be like, all right, let me think of something that's going to blow everybody's mind. Exactly.
And why they do what they do.
Everyone knows this track and is vibing to it. And that was just a special feeling.
Music Life.
I guess this is just my destiny.
Find the first 3 episodes now by searching for Music Life wherever you get your podcasts.